From the home of the Codebreakers and the birthplace of modern computing, this is the Bletchley Park podcast. It's been a busy few weeks in the spotlight at Bletchley Park. Around 4 million people watched The Bletchley Circle, the ITV drama which started its mainly post-war story here in Hut 11. Then came the programme those in the know had been waiting to see since March. Celebrity MasterChef filmed one of its final week challenges here, under a very Bletchley Park appropriate veil of secrecy. The CEO of the Bletchley Park Trust, Ian Standen, took his place at the table alongside veteran co-breakers for a fine dining experience, with one course cooked by each of the three finalists. So you have not been able to escape Bletchley Park on the telly almost lately. What's been the highlight for you?
I suppose the personal highlight was filming MasterChef. We filmed that back in March and finally went to air in September. It was a fantastic evening, some great food produced by the finalists in MasterChef and some great company with eight of our veterans there around the table.
With visitor numbers soaring as they are, it can be a bit of an upheaval to actually close off bits of the museum for filming. But overall, just tell me about why you feel that's worth it.
Oh, it's worth it at every occasion. The exposure we get at Bletchley Park from the media, whether it's in films or in TV programmes, is invaluable. It's the sort of exposure you just can't buy.
And MasterChef is an example of the lighter side. It's not a history programme, it's not a technology or science documentary, it's something else altogether.
Yes, MasterChef, and indeed we've filmed a number of similar sorts of programmes that will take Bletchley Park to an audience that doesn't usually see it, an audience not necessarily engaged with the Bletchley Park story until they actually see the programme.
Like Escape to the Country, for example, which you'll also be on. Do you know how much that's repeated?
Indeed, it's amazing to see how much it's repeated, on not just on the BBC, but on various other channels, of course. Yes, we filmed that, again, about a month or so ago, and I think it's due to go to air in the spring 2013, which will, again, take us to a wider audience.
Bletchley Circle's been hugely popular. I mean, was it about 4 million viewers?
I think it was, yes, averaged over the three episodes. And another great exposure, a different audience again, a drama programme anchored in Bletchley Park, evoking 1950s life, bringing to life, really, the lives of many of the women who work here, who went on to, in many cases, back to rather routine lives after the excitement and frenetic activity of Bletchley Park.
I remember Ruth Bourne, who was one of our veteran bomb operators. She was a Wren, and she was talking about how she remembers watching the drums of a washing machine go around when she worked in a laundrette after the war, and it was reminding her of the bombs. And it just puts it into context, doesn't it?
Indeed. It amazes me how they could be doing the work they were doing here in the war and then go back to routine life. But I guess that was the pattern of things in the 1940s and 50s.
And there was a lovely theme about them keeping their silence as well in that programme, because, and in a way, you can't quite bring that to life in a documentary quite in the same way that you can in a drama, because you care about the characters and you get to know them in a different way, even though they're fictional and the setting was fictional, that they couldn't tell their husbands, or they couldn't explain why they knew these things. It was a theme throughout that, wasn't it?
Absolutely. It is a very powerful theme, and one that you come across time and time again when you meet our veterans here. You see that they did keep these secrets, didn't tell anybody, husbands, wives, parents and what have you. Indeed, many sad occasions where parents perhaps went to the grave not knowing the important work their children did during the war.
The pride they could have had. Some of them must have been mildly embarrassed that they weren't in more active service.
That's certainly the case from my experience talking to veterans again, and there are some who felt that perhaps they weren't doing their part, which of course belies the important nature of the work they were doing here.
A rare Enigma machine used in the Spanish Civil War has taken its place in the Bletchley Park Museum. It's one of two machines given to GCHQ back in March by its Spanish counterpart. The machine adds a pre-war chapter to the story of the British code-breaking effort. It's joined one of the largest collections of Enigma machines on public display anywhere in the world. I spoke to volunteer guide and Enigma expert Frank Carter.
I'm sure you're well aware of the fact that the history of Enigma goes back a long way to the 1920s. The earliest machines that were manufactured were put on the open market. Banks and other industrial organisations might have used them in connection with the public telegraph system. It didn't work out that way. They were not a commercial success. But a number of machines were manufactured with different wiring in the rotors and used for a variety of purposes. I believe even the German forces used it experimentally, that simpler machine, in the about 1926 or so. A little later on, when the Germans had developed a more robust machine, the one that was used during the war, they did supply samples of the earlier machine to General Franco and to Mussolini. And one could see there's a certain cynicism there, because although they supported both those sort of fascist regimes, they could read their signals. But Franco and the Italian Navy used the early three-rotor machines in the late 1930s, and they were broken by Dilly Knox, using a hand technique, which for some arcane reasons he called rodding. But it meant that the British, who were getting anxious about the civil war in Spain, because it was affecting the theatre of interest that we had in the Mediterranean, and so they were keen to read Franco's signals, and they would have been enciphered on the sort of machine of which we now have that sample in the museum, and the British were able to read those quite easily and fluently. And later on, if I just digress, the Italian ciphers were also broken, and that paid dividends in 1941 when Mavis Beatty played a very prominent role in the successful breaking of the Italian Navy ciphers, and the result was a spectacular success for the British in the Mediterranean when we badly needed one, 1941, the Battle of Cape Matapan.
And so I understand these machines, the pair that have come into the ownership of GCHQ, one of which is now on display in Block B, were found sort of mouldering away in a back cupboard, forgotten.
Apparently so. From a technical point of view, they would become obsolete pretty quickly after the cessation of the Second World War, if not before. But presumably the fascist regime must have just put them in somewhere other cupboard, as you say, and then they've forgotten.
Does it make you wonder what else might be out there in cupboards somewhere?
Well, it's a matter of conjecture, I suppose. I can't imagine anything of any significance that we don't know about. I wouldn't have thought so. But those two machines don't really reveal anything new to us. It's simply that they're historic relics from another period.
It's another chapter of the story, isn't it?
It is. And we ought to put up a little display about that at some time, featuring Dilly Knox, who tends to get rather airbrushed out of the story of Bletchley Park. That's just another reason why his story should be told, I think. And it isn't at the moment. That's one of Mavis Beatty's roles in life, to try and promote Dilly Knox and make sure he's not forgotten.
Well, it's difficult, isn't it? Because when focus lands on one eminent codebreaker, inevitably it pales on the others slightly. And it must be frustrating for people who remember and know a lot about what certain people achieved.
Well, yes, I think sometimes the danger of visitors will come in and they have a look round, they go on a tour, and they go away and say, right, well, the Germans invented the Enigma machine in the beginning of the war, which is not true, of course. It was successfully broken by Alan Turing, and that won the war. End of story. It's perhaps a parody, but that it's not far removed from the image that some people have.
Do you think it's fair to say, though, Frank, that when someone knows as much about what happened as you do, and as some of your volunteer colleagues, and certainly some of the veterans like Mavis, it must be incredibly frustrating when people just nibble the very top layer of the story, even when they don't get it wrong?
Well, of course, it's understandable. The story is so complex and detailed, it's unreasonable to suppose that a casual visitor can acquire all that perspective. You've got to have these toe dippers, swimmers and divers, this sort of analogy you've no doubt heard of. It's perfectly true. If you tried to do everything on the grand scale for every visitor, they'd be frightened to death. They'd go home by lunchtime and be thoroughly fed up. We've got a fair bit about Turing around the place, and of course the bomb is a physical legacy of what he did. There's little about Knox, because he was very secretive. He didn't get on with other people, quarrelled with most men, and the director, most of the time, was threatening to resign from day to day. And his hand methods, we do have a modest display about them, but it's not as exciting as a machine. These little bits of cardboard you have to work with great patience and so on. But he was a very remarkable man, and his success in breaking the so-called Abwehr Enigma machine, this special version of Enigma used by the German Secret Service, with the horrific problem, all these multiple turnovers of the rotors. And, I mean, he achieved that at the time he was suffering physically, he had cancer. And the fact he got that out, that was his greatest triumph, I think. People look at that machine, another version of Enigma, but they're not aware of the enormous story that lay behind that. And it's not easy to portray, because Knox didn't write anything about it. There is the famous report we now have, which was only put in the public domain last year, I think, Beatty, Beatty, Rock and Twin, about Enigma systems. And there's an account of it in there, of course, but the learning curve is steep and it's not for everyone.
How glad are you now that the Spanish Enigma machine has taken its place among our collection?
Well, I think it's another part of the jigsaw puzzle. Indeed, we've got an Italian machine, we've got a Spanish machine, and of course we've got all the varieties of German Enigma. So I think our collection in the museum now is probably second to none anywhere to show the range and variety of machines that were operating during the Second World War.
Thank you. Time to look at some upcoming events at Bletchley Park, and Mythbusters is fast approaching. On Sunday the 14th of October at 1 o'clock, you can lay to rest some of the misapprehensions surrounding the Bletchley Park story, which were an unavoidable side effect of the long-term ultra level of secrecy. Bletchley Park's fireworks spectacular takes place on Saturday the 3rd of November, with rousing wartime music, a dazzling fireworks display, and if you're really lucky, a sausage in a bun. And finally, the winter lecture series continues on the 8th of November, when Virginia Nicholson talks about the contrasting stories of the Women's War. Millions Like Us looks at how the Second World War affected women, both in the services and on the home front. Bletchley Park is proud to present the special edition Alan Turing Monopoly Board in the codebreaker, mathematician and computer scientist centenary year. The board is raising funds for the Bletchley Park Trust, with support from the man who drew the original more than 60 years ago. William Newman, the son of Max, Alan Turing's friend and mentor, donated the original to the Bletchley Park Museum, having beaten Alan Turing on the board when he was just 12. William came to the mansion to play against journalists on the new special edition board. Jenna Benson from BBC Three Counties Radio took up the challenge.
What would you like to be, the car or the hat?
I'll be the hat. The board that we're talking about is one that I drew on a piece of paper probably when I was about, I don't know, maybe about 12. Monopoly board sets were rather expensive. So rather than try and persuade my parents to fork out, I thought, well, why don't I just draw a Monopoly board?
And as for the game where you managed to beat Alan Turing, what do you remember of that moment?
No, a slight embarrassment. I just remember that we played it. It was just a Monopoly game like any other one. You know, many years afterwards, I assumed that he had some sort of strategy for how to win. But I think, on reflection, he probably didn't want to win. He made sure that he didn't.
The original board was lost for a number of years.
Yes, well, it sort of lay around in the family house in Cambridge until my father died in 84. And then the house was sold to a couple who have really sort of taken it to their hearts. They looked after it and preserved it and kept things they found, which included the Monopoly board. And so when I went out there, I took my son with me because he hadn't been there. So we went out there so that I could just show him the house. It's on a crossroads. And the owners saw me and said, oh, would you like to come in? So we had a proper tour. And when we left, he handed me this folder, opened it, and there it was.
And how did you feel getting that game back after so many years?
I was really pleased.
And now the board has been donated to Bletchley Park.
Yes. I think I was pleased because it survived, not because I'd been denied the opportunity to play Monopoly for all these years. And now it's at Bletchley Park. It seemed to me highly appropriate that they should look after it.
The board we've got in front of us is the developed board. It doesn't have the diagonal line across it anymore.
No.
But it is now a Monopoly board. It's been changed and turned into one, and it will be released. How do you feel about that, seeing what you created so many years ago at the age of 12 being developed into a board game that will be sold and played by many, many people?
Well, I think it's a brilliant idea. I think anything that publicises his name and his career, anything that gets people to know more about him, I think is just a splendid thing to do.
Hi, I'm Peter Griffin. I'm Development Director of Winning Moves Games Company.
Well, Peter, we're standing near to the original Monopoly board drawn by William. Mm. When you saw this board with a diagonal line across and a turnaround square, yes. Did you think there's no way that this could possibly be a Monopoly board?
Yes, I mean, there are certainly, it's recognisable as Monopoly for sure. You have the four corner squares, go, free parking, and the other two as well. You know, it's highly recognisable there. But when William drew this up, he changed a lot around, which is both fantastic to see, creativity around Monopoly, but it was also rather shocking as well. Bletchley called me up about a year ago and said, have you heard of a chap called Alan Turing? I said, well yes, actually I have, because I went to King's College, Cambridge, where Alan Turing also studied, and he was professor there as well. So I used to do my essays in the tiny computer room, which of course was the Turing room. And so I said to Bletchley, well, yeah, actually, do know a little bit about it. Why? What's the project? And they said, well, we've got this Monopoly board. And from that moment, we knew we had to do something with this and help Bletchley out. And here we are today.
On the new board, every little detail has been looked after. Even the chance cards are aimed at Alan Turing's life.
Well, yes, that's the idea. We wanted to, well, first of all, the squares, the traditional Monopoly squares, so rather than Mayfair and Park Lane, we wanted those squares to tell the story of Alan Turing's life. So each block of properties, so the blue set, for example, are places where he grew up and the schools he visited. We have one of the sets is universities he went to, one of the sets is where he worked. And then Mayfair, we've reserved for a very special place, of course, Bletchley Park and Park Lane, King's College. The real fun was with the Chancellor Community Chess Cards, because we knew we wanted to give little hints, not too much, but little hints and maybe, dare I say it, cryptic clues to Alan Turing's life, so people could, when they play the game, can break their own code. So, for example, rather than go to Mayfair, which was the original chance card, it's now go to Bletchley Park. But more than go to Bletchley Park, it says, Auntie Flo is not so well, go to Bletchley Park. And I'll give that one away. When the code breakers were called up to Bletchley Park during the Second World War, the code was they would receive a telegram with a very simple phrase. Guess what? It said, Auntie Flo is not so well. So there we go. The chance card changed to Auntie Flo is not so well. Go to Bletchley Park.
First-hand memories of the code-breaking work carried out at Bletchley Park are always worth hearing. So when veteran Royal Navy bomb operator Ruth Bourne came to Bletchley Park to film Escape to the Country, I asked her to share her memories of Hut 11A, the bomb room, as the Trust is trying to raise £250,000 to restore it to its wartime condition and open it as part of the museum. I started by asking her what her first memory was of a bomb machine.
Well, when we were faced with the bomb machine, I was quite terrified. There were all these drums going round and round. I didn't know where to begin. But luckily, we had a month of training, 2 weeks approximately of just watching, and then 2 weeks of hands-on experience being watched. Then after that, we were on our own.
And was it technically quite a challenge to learn to use it, to operate it?
Well, to be honest, I don't remember. I only remember that I was quite happy doing it by the end of the month. Also being let into the secret. When we were being told we were going to do special duties, we were also told, it's lucky you're 5'4½", but they didn't know why it was useful to be that height. But now, when we saw the machines, we realised that we had to be about that in order to reach the top row of the drums.
There are all these wrens of uniform height then?
Well, no, I think to begin with they had people who were not quite tall enough, and one of my colleagues, who's a very excellent bomb operator, had to be told to stand on a plank of wood or something to reach the top row. And then perhaps they became a little more careful about. But quite a lot of the girls, now I come to think of it, and when you come here to the reunions, they are quite tall ladies, even now, on the whole.
And so when you look at it now, does it take you right back?
No, it's like it was all happening yesterday. It all comes back to you, especially when you are demonstrating and you pull the drums off and put them on.
Strange to think that you couldn't have imagined, surely, when you were working on them during the war, that there would be the level of interest there is now in this story and what happened here.
It was amazing because, as you may know, after the war this place closed down from obviously what it was doing. And it was used by many different organisations. There was a teacher training college here. the post office had a presence here, magistrates' court here. And it was only about 21 years ago that it was decided, a group of veterans came together and decided to try and save it as a heritage site. And it's taken a long, hard slog to bring it up to the amazing success that it is today.
Well, with the interest in it that there is today and in the story and in coming here and soaring visitor numbers, you'd never guess the struggle it was and for how long it was repeatedly saved from the bulldozers and came close to ruin.
Indeed it was. The struggle for funding, a lot of companies were very generous. And, of course, the people who rebuilt this bomb machine gave all their time for free.
And it's an incredible, it's not a replica, it's a rebuilt bomb, it's a fully operational bomb. And can you describe to me what you think when you watch it running?
It's difficult to be accurate about this because when we were trained, we were told not to ask questions, really. Do what you're told, do this, that and the other, and don't ask why. The only thing we were told, that we were given to understand, it was one of the most secret machines in the whole war, which filled us with awe and respect. And we never heard the word Enigma mentioned. Speaking for myself and the girls who worked with me at the time, we didn't know why there were three drums. We didn't know why there was a set of drums that didn't work. We didn't know why we were plugging those things. We didn't understand the menu. We knew that we operated it according to the instructions on the menu. And when the bomb stopped, we were also trained to validate the stop on a different checking machine. And if we had certain confirmations and no self-couples, because the Enigma can't encrypt its own letter, if it was a good stop, we phoned it through on the voice scrambler, red telephone, to the hut. We had our own mini code. If you were working in a big bay, for instance, we had bays full of machinery, 10 machines to 12 machines. If you worked in a bay called Norway and your machine had its own name, you would ring up and say, Norway Checker, I have a good stop for you on Bergen, Stavanger, Tromso, whatever. And that's all you'd need to say. Even if somebody picked up your voice, they wouldn't know what you were talking about. They would know what actual menu you were running and where your machine was located and how many other machines in that location were running the same menu. They knew everything. And they would take down the information that you gave them about the drums and the rings and the steckers, and they would put it onto their own Enigma machines, which we had captured, liberated. We had our own Typex machines, which were our encrypting machines, and we could set those up to emulate an Enigma, and then they would put the information we had given them onto that setting, and if the key was a good one, they would press the encryption and clear German letters, a reasonable number of them, recognizable ones, would come up, and then they would tell you job up, but you never knew what was in it or anything of that nature. And, of course, here in Bletchley, they had their linguists who could fill in the gaps. And then you were off, and you could then read all those messages from that particular war zone for the whole 24 hours until they changed the settings on the Enigmas. Then you started again.
We're fundraising now to rehouse this in the original hut where it was used, and the building was built for it. What's your memories of that building?
Very, very vague, because I was here for less than a couple of weeks. It was my initial bit of training. I signed the official street contract here. I joined in July, August of 1944. I seem to remember it was hot and noisy, and I remember going to bed and closed my eyes. I could hear the click, click, click as the machine went round and round. But you got used to that, and with a very short time we were moved on to one of the big out stations. I remember much more about that, and the fact that there were no less than 12 machines in these bays, and they were much more impressive, because whereas the huts were quite small, these big bays, they had very high brick walls with barbed wire all around, and army soldiers at the gate, and bayonets, and you had to show your pass. was much more impressive, really, than the few machines that were here in the huts.
Well, that's the thing about Bletchley Park. It all looks so unassuming, doesn't it?
Even more unassuming. You wouldn't have seen anything then. All you would have seen was a few very boring-looking wooden huts, some big brick buildings, a big mansion which we never got anywhere near. And as far as I remember, I may be incorrect, but the Wrens didn't even go in the canteen with all the other civilians and people. I think the Navy victualled us separately. It's all very vague, but I remember it because I stayed quite a long time in the outstations. So I remember those much better.
You're coming to the reunion this weekend.
Yeah.
What does that mean to you each year, that event?
It's very nice to meet people that I've met in previous events. One was my petty officer in Eastcote, who's now sadly passed on, Peggy Erskine Tulloch, who made one of these menus for this bomb. She was able to remember it from all those years. And another lady, again, who's passed on, who I met, she was actually a very close friend of mine.
And in recent years, you've done quite a lot of interviews and talks and been able to spread the word quite a lot, haven't you?
All of us who work here as guides have tried to spread the word. And although many of my colleagues don't come here like I do to do tours and talks, they all, in their own field, give talks wherever they live. There are always organisations who want a speaker. Usually they're raising money for charity. And we go round and we do these talks and these other ladies and gentlemen who worked here in the war, and that does spread the word. I remember when I came here first, it was about between 16 and 18 years ago. People who have come here never heard anything about it. If I said, oh, I work in a museum at Bletchley, never heard of it. Now everybody knows of it, almost everybody.
And we're going to keep trying to tell more and more people, obviously.
We have a large education department here, and of course it's part of the history syllabus, and we have given talks in schools. I've given two talks at a local school at Milton Keynes, and the children have come here with somewhat garbled ideas sometimes. I remember one little boy from a school near Milton Keynes, he said, we know all about Colossus. The ladies there work naked. The deal was that if it got very hot and there were no engineers around, they would take off a lot of their outer garment. If you've been there on a hot day and stood inside there for 5 minutes, you'd be extremely hot. And in F block, we had 10 Colossus machines all chucking out their heat, you can imagine.
But you, Wrens, operating the bomb, didn't do any more than roll up your sleeves, I gather.
We were allowed, believe it or not, to roll up our shirt sleeves during the day and the evening watch. And at night, we had the privilege of not even having to wear shirts. We could wear what is known as square rig, which is a naval white shirt with a square neck piped in navy blue. And that had no sleeves, virtually. And it was cotton. It was very, very cool and comfortable. And we didn't, therefore, have a shirt and tie. We were allowed to wear that on the midnight watch with bell-bottom trousers.
Well, thank you so much for sharing all those memories. It's been a privilege. Thanks to the staff, volunteers and veterans of Bletchley Park who took part in this podcast. For more information, go to bletchleypark.org.uk or find us on iTunes. Also, follow us on Twitter, where we are at @bparkpodcast, and join our Facebook group. Thanks to Audioboo, who make this podcast possible. This podcast is produced for the Bletchley Park Trust by MC Fontaine. Thanks for listening, and we'll have more decrypts from the home of the Codebreakers next month.